In the first year of the Great Exodus, when the children of Israel departed from the land of Egypt, it was during the third month, precisely on the 16th day, that the Almighty God summoned Moses. He called with a voice of immense authority, a sound that resonated across the wilderness and shook the very foundation of the sacred mount, saying, "Ascend now and come to me upon this hallowed peak. I shall bestow upon you two tablets fashioned from stone, inscribed not merely with words, but with the very essence of my eternal law and commandments, which you shall meticulously teach and engrave upon the hearts of my chosen people." Moses, recognizing the profound weight of this divine instruction, obeyed immediately and ascended the rugged slopes of the Mount of God. Upon Mount Sinai, the luminous, overwhelming glory of the Lord descended in an awesome display of power, completely enshrouding the mountain in a thick, swirling cloud that remained undisturbed for 6 full days. Then, as the sun rose on the 7th day, God called to Moses from the very heart of that ethereal darkness. To any observer who dared look upon the mountain, a sight they beheld only from a distance, the glory of the Lord was an indescribable, consuming blaze of celestial fire resting fixedly at the mountain's peak. Moses remained upon that holy mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, in complete communion with the Creator. During that sacred time, God unveiled to him the full scope of time and existence, all that was, all that is now, and all that shall be, the grand, sweeping design of human history and the precise, sacred rhythm of days, weeks, and years that govern all law and testimony. And the voice of God spoke, decreeing, "Let your heart take firm hold of every single word I declare to you here this day, Moses, and commit them faithfully to writing in a book. Do this so that the future generations of Israel will clearly see that even in the fullness of their forthcoming misdeeds and transgressions, I have never once truly abandoned them. They shall surely stray far from the covenant I establish with you this very day upon Mount Sinai, yet my faithfulness shall remain utterly steadfast." When these severe tribulations and calamities finally come upon them, they will at last be forced to confront my perfect justice, recognizing that I have been infinitely more faithful to them than they ever chose to be toward me. Write down with precision all that I speak to you this day, for I know the inherent stubbornness of their spirit and the deep hardness of their hearts. They are a people inherently prone to rebellion, destined to turn aside even before I fulfill my promise and bring them into the land I pledged to their forefathers, the rich, fertile land I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, a land overflowing with the verdant richness of milk and honey. They will feast and grow satisfied, prosperous and secure, but then, in their arrogance, they will turn their backs upon me, rushing headlong to embrace detestable idols, false gods that possess neither the ability to help them nor the power to save them in their desperate time of need. This written testimony you create will stand as an eternal, unwavering witness against them, for they will deliberately abandon my foundational commandments and eagerly follow the decadent ways of the surrounding nations, embracing impurity, apostasy, and utter shame. They will serve false deities, and these carved idols will become their ultimate ruin, bringing unbearable sorrow, relentless warfare, and widespread affliction upon their lives. Many thousands will perish. Many more will be taken captive, delivered helpless into the ruthless hands of their enemies because they have utterly forsaken my righteous ordinances and the sacred festivals of my covenant. They will utterly neglect my appointed Sabbaths, disregard my holy dwelling place, and profane the very tabernacle I have sanctified in their midst, meant to bear my holy name and be a cherished dwelling place for my divine presence. They will defiantly construct altars upon high places across the hillsides, raise sacred groves for illicit worship, and carve images of false, impotent gods, each one bowing in reverence to his own vain creation. They will even descend into unspeakable darkness, sacrificing their own innocent children to malicious demons, committing acts born of the deepest spiritual blackness within their hearts. I will send my prophets repeatedly to warn them, to call them back passionately to the path of righteousness and obedience, but they will not only fail to listen, they will persecute my prophets, ruthlessly slaying those who seek only to uphold my law and maliciously altering my eternal decrees to bring forth evil directly before my eyes. Then I shall completely turn my face away from them, removing my protection and allowing them to fall decisively into the hands of the Gentiles. They shall become wretched captives, relentlessly scattered across distant foreign lands, consumed and devoured by their oppressors. They will forget my laws, my commandments, my sacred times and holy days, straying utterly from my ordinances and wandering like sheep that have lost their shepherd forever. Yet, in the final culmination of time, from among those very nations, they will return to me with the fullness of all their heart, soul, and strength. When they seek me wholeheartedly, with genuine repentance and devotion, I shall compassionately gather them back from the Gentiles. In that destined time, they will truly find me, and I shall reveal to them a lasting peace overflowing with an unending river of righteousness. I will purify them entirely and plant them as a lasting, fruitful seed of righteousness deep within my own heart and soul. They shall become a blessing to the world, not a curse. They shall be the head of nations, not the subservient tail. I shall establish my eternal sanctuary permanently in their midst, dwelling forever among them, and I will truly be their God, and they will be my people, bound in unbreakable truth and perfect righteousness. I will never again abandon them. I am the Lord, their God, who keeps covenant. Overwhelmed by the terrible prophecy and the vision of future suffering, Moses fell prostrate upon his face and desperately prayed, O Lord, my God, do not forsake your people, your chosen and cherished inheritance. Do not permit them to fall into such grievous error, nor deliver them completely into the tyrannical hands of the Gentiles, lest they be led hopelessly astray and made to sin grievously against your holy will. Raise up your boundless mercy upon them, O Lord, and grant them a pervasive spirit of uprightness. Do not allow the spirit of evil to rule over them, accusing them ceaselessly before you and leading them ultimately into eternal ruin. They are your unique people, your inheritance, rescued by your mighty and outstretched hand from the iron grasp of Egypt. Breathe into them a clean heart, a pure and holy spirit, that they may never be permanently ensnared by the deceit of sin for all time. And the Lord replied firmly to Moses, I know their inherent stubbornness, their resistance to spiritual truth. They will not choose to turn back until they fully acknowledge their own accumulated sins and the sins inherited from their forefathers. Then, and only then, will they return to me in full sincerity and devotion, and I will tenderly cleanse their hearts and the hearts of their descendants, instilling in them a pervasive Holy Spirit. From that promised day forward, they will cling fast to me and my commandments. They shall be my children, and I will be their father forevermore. They will be known by all creation as the children of the living God. Every angel, every exalted spirit in the heavenly realms, will look upon them and know beyond doubt that they are my own, that I am their father in righteousness, and that my love for them is utterly true and enduring. Now, write down every single word I have declared to you on this mountain, the beginning and the conclusion of all that will come to pass, concerning every law, testimony, week, and jubilee, until the glorious time when I shall descend permanently to dwell with them forever. And God spoke immediately to the angel of his presence, the one who attends him, saying, Record meticulously for Moses the complete, comprehensive account, beginning from the very moment of creation until the distant day when my eternal sanctuary shall be firmly established among them on earth. Then he continued, The appointed day will surely come when I shall reveal myself openly, not just to a few, but to all of creation, and every eye will bear witness that I am the God of Israel, the loving Father of all the children of Jacob, and the everlasting King established forever on Mount Zion. Both Zion and Jerusalem shall be sanctified, set apart and holy for all time and eternity. The angel of the presence, the same glorious being who had guided the camp of Israel through their wandering journey, took up the sacred tablets. These tablets were not only inscribed with the divisions of years but also the precise laws, the testimony of weeks, and the cycles of the jubilees, meticulously tracing time back to the moment of creation itself. These detailed records encompassed every age and year, every sacred law and covenant, all kept faithfully and held until the destined day when God's sanctuary would be established in Jerusalem, upon Mount Zion. In that coming time, even the heavens and the earth would undergo a wondrous renewal, and every celestial luminary would shine forth with healing, peace, and immeasurable blessings for the chosen people of Israel. From that day forward, the world would be restored to a perfect harmony that would endure throughout all generations. The angel then spoke directly to Moses, delivering God's explicit words, Write down the entire account of creation, detailing precisely how in six momentous days the Lord God completed all his works, and how on the seventh day, he rested and profoundly blessed it, consecrating it as an everlasting sign of his completion for all eternity. On the first day, he meticulously formed the heavens above and the earth below, the expansive waters, and all the attendant spirits that serve ceaselessly before him, the glorious angels of the presence, the radiant angels of sanctification, the spirits of consuming fire, of swift winds, of gathering clouds, of impenetrable darkness, of snow, of freezing hail, and of hoary frost. He created the angels of thunder, of powerful lightning, of piercing cold, of blazing heat, of winter, spring, autumn, and summer. Indeed, all the myriad spirits that fill heaven and earth. He brought forth the abyssal depths, the contrast of the dark and the light, the transition of evening and night, and the cycle of dawn and day, all precisely according to the unfathomable wisdom within his divine heart. On that day alone, we beheld his mighty works unfolding and burst into songs of praise before him. For on that first day, he brought forth seven magnificent, foundational creations. On the second day, he commanded the formation of the firmament, the vast expanse, setting it decisively amidst the waters, dividing them so that half rose above the firmament and half remained below, spanning the whole earth in precise order. This singular, essential work alone he completed on the second day. Then, on the third day, he spoke his command to the waters, instructing them to gather into one appointed place, allowing the dry land, the mainland, to emerge. And the waters immediately obeyed, retreating swiftly to their designated basins, leaving the dry land bare and visible. On that very same day, he fashioned the seas, each great gathering of water in its own appointed space. He formed the flowing rivers, the hidden pools of water in the mountains and across the earth's surface, the vast lakes, and the gentle mists that blanket the ground. Furthermore, he planted every seed and sprouting thing, every tree that bears nourishing fruit, every wood tree, and the Garden of Eden itself, made abundant with every variety of plant after its specific kind. These four great works he completed and established on the third day. On the fourth day, he set the sun, the moon, and the myriad stars in the heavens, placing them fixedly in the firmament to cast their glorious light upon the earth, ruling over the appointed day and the night, and dividing the light permanently from the darkness, so that all creation might know its appointed times and boundaries. And so, God appointed the radiant sun to serve as a great beacon over the earth, marking the days, the sacred Sabbaths, the turning months, the solemn holy feasts, and the passing years. It would meticulously govern the cycles of Sabbath years and the great jubilees, declaring the seasons of the earth with perfect precision in their appointed time. By its light, he set apart day from night, filling all creation with the dynamic energy of life, ensuring that all things growing on earth might flourish abundantly in their season. Thus, on the fourth day, he brought forth these three crucial kinds of creation. On the fifth day, he cast his mighty command deep into the waters, calling forth the great sea monsters and all life that swims and moves in the vast oceans. These creatures were the first of living flesh, the works of his hands, beasts that glide gracefully through the waters, fish in their uncountable multitudes, and the birds of every kind soaring across the expanse of the sky. The sun rose above them, blessing their existence, and above all that grew upon the earth, every tree bearing fruit, every living thing. In these, he completed three kinds of creation on the fifth day. And on the sixth day, he carefully shaped from the earth all manner of animals, creatures that walk and crawl upon the ground, the wild beasts and the domesticated cattle. And after all of this, he turned his hand to make humankind. A man and a woman he formed, shaping them with unique purpose and divine power, gifting them absolute dominion over every living creature, the beasts of the fields, the fish of the seas, the birds of the sky, and indeed, over all the expanse of the earth. Four distinct kinds of creation he brought forth on this defining day. In all, he made 22 kinds of creatures and elements, completing his monumental work on the sixth day, all that fills the heavens, the earth, the seas, the abyssal depths, and every realm of light and darkness. And on the seventh day, he gave to us a powerful eternal sign, the Sabbath. 6 days shall we labor and bring forth our work, but the seventh is a day profoundly set apart, a day to rest from all work and toil. In the heavens, all the angels of the presence, and the angels of sanctification, two great and glorious hosts, were hidden with him, to observe and honor the Sabbath, just as it is observed and hallowed upon the earth. And he said to us, See, I shall separate unto myself a distinct people from among all the nations of the world. They shall diligently keep the Sabbath, and I will consecrate them as my holy people, distinguishing them from all others. I will bless them profoundly, for as I have sanctified the Sabbath for myself, so shall I sanctify them as my very own. They will be my people forever, and I shall be their God. I have chosen the lineage of Jacob from among all I have created, and I have lovingly called him my firstborn son. I have sanctified his descendants for eternity. They shall learn meticulously to observe the Sabbath, to rest completely from all work, and to know that it is inherently holy. And thus, he marked an explicit sign within creation itself, an invitation that they should join us, the heavenly host, in observing the Sabbath on the seventh day. It is a mandated day to gather, to eat and drink in fellowship, to bless the one who created all things, who has consecrated unto himself a chosen people, elevated above all other nations, to share eternally in the observance of the Sabbath with us. He caused his commands to rise like a fragrant offering, profoundly pleasing to him through all the ages. There were 22 heads of humankind from Adam to Jacob, precisely matching the 22 works of creation he brought forth until the seventh day, a day that stands uniquely holy and eternally blessed. And Jacob and his descendants were granted this immutable promise, that they would forever remain the chosen and sanctified, the recipients of the first covenant and law, just as he blessed and sanctified the seventh day above all others. He created the heavens, the earth, and all that exists within them in six dynamic days, and on the seventh day he consecrated it, setting it apart forever from all his other works. Thus, he commanded that any who willfully defile this sacred day shall surely die, for the seventh day is holier than all other days and times. And he explicitly instructed, Speak clearly to the children of Israel, that they may observe this day, keeping it holy, taking extreme care not to defile it, for it is the holiest of all days. Whoever profanes it by work shall surely die, and those who labor on this day will die eternally in spirit, for the Sabbath is a perpetual sign for them through all generations, so that they may remain securely in the land and not be violently uprooted from their inheritance. To those who faithfully keep the Sabbath, he promised holiness and unending blessing through all the days of their lives, making them like unto the angels themselves. Proclaim this law with authority to the children of Israel, warning them that they must not stray from it according to the evil inclinations of their hearts, and that they must not engage in any work that serves only their own self-interest or desires. On this day, they shall not prepare food or drink, nor draw fresh water, nor carry any cumbersome burdens through their gates, nor transfer anything between their houses. These preparations must be absolutely completed on the sixth day, so that the seventh remains utterly undisturbed and reserved for rest. For this day is holier and more profoundly blessed than even the day of the Jubilees. On this day we, the heavenly host, kept Sabbath in the heavens before any living flesh knew of the Sabbath upon the earth. The Creator of all things blessed it eternally, yet he did not sanctify all nations to keep it. Only Israel, whom he specially permitted to eat, drink, and rest upon it, here on earth. He consecrated this day above all others, marking it with a blessing and sanctification beyond compare. This law was given to the children of Israel as an everlasting commandment, a testimony for all their future generations. In the 6 days of the second week of creation, as God commanded, the angels meticulously brought every creature before Adam. Each of the beasts of the field, all the domesticated cattle, the birds of the sky, and every creature that moved upon the earth and within the waters, each according to its inherent kind and type, was presented before him. The wild beasts came on the first day, the cattle on the second, the birds on the third, the creeping things of the earth on the fourth, and those that swam in the waters on the fifth. One by one, Adam intently looked upon them, and as he named each creature, so precisely it was called thereafter. For 5 days, he reviewed them all, male and female, in every kind and manner that walked the earth. Yet, for all their numbers and magnificent variety, he remained profoundly alone, finding no companion that was truly his equal. Then the Lord spoke to the attending angels. It is not good or fitting for the man to remain in solitude. Let us create a fitting companion for him, one who mirrors his essence. So the Lord God caused a deep, heavy, and dreamless sleep to fall upon Adam, and while he slept soundly, he took a single rib from his side. From this rib, he formed the woman, skillfully weaving flesh in its place and shaping her exquisitely by his own divine hand. When Adam awoke, he rose to find her standing gracefully before him. Recognizing her as an intrinsic part of himself, he spoke with utter wonder. At last, here is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall henceforth be called my wife, for she was taken specifically from her husband. From that moment, man and woman would be eternally bound together as one, commanded to leave father and mother, and joining to one another, becoming a single, inseparable flesh. Adam was created in the first week, and the woman, his beloved companion, was presented to him in the second week. This precise order gave rise to the commandment concerning ritual purity. For the birth of a male child, the period of cleansing is 7 days. For a female child, the period is twice 7 days. 40 days after his initial creation, Adam was gently brought into the Garden of Eden, a place of unparalleled beauty and abundant life, to tend it and watch over its perfection. His wife joined him after 80 days had passed, and together they entered the garden. For this divine order, the law was subsequently inscribed in heaven. When a woman gives birth to a son, she shall remain in her state of cleansing for 7 days, followed by 33 days in the blood of her purification, during which she shall not touch anything sacred or enter the sanctuary. But for a daughter, she shall remain in her state of cleansing for 14 days, and 66 days in the blood of her purification, totaling 80 days. Only then would she be fully purified and allowed to return, for the garden was held to be more holy and consecrated than all the rest of the earth, with every tree within it set apart as sacred. Thus it was decreed concerning any woman who bears a child, that she may touch no holy thing nor enter any sacred place until her days of purification are completely finished, according to the eternal heavenly law. In the first jubilee, during the first week, Adam and his wife lived in the Garden of Eden for 7 peaceful years, diligently working and caring for its bounty. The angels of God instructed him in all the necessary tasks for the land's nurture, and Adam toiled, entirely unaware of his nakedness, feeling no hint of shame. He guarded the garden faithfully from intruding birds, wild beasts, and cattle, gathering its succulent fruits to eat and carefully saving the excess for himself and his wife. After exactly 7 years passed, in the second month on the 17th day, a serpent, the most cunning of creatures, approached the woman. It questioned her with a voice laced with subtle deceit and poisonous curiosity. "Did God truly say you may not eat from every single tree in the garden?" The woman replied, "We are freely permitted to eat the fruit of any tree we choose, but concerning the tree in the very center of the garden, God commanded strictly, 'Do not eat of it, nor even touch it, lest you surely die.'" But the serpent whispered, its tone mockingly confident, "You shall not surely die. God knows that the instant you eat it, your spiritual eyes will be opened, and you shall instantly become like gods, possessing the knowledge of both intrinsic good and absolute evil." The woman looked upon the tree and saw that its fruit was visually pleasing and highly desirable as a means to gain wisdom. She immediately reached out, took of its forbidden fruit, and ate. Then, sensing her new and sudden nakedness, she instinctively covered herself with large fig leaves. She then gave some of the fruit to Adam, who ate without questioning. And in that very moment, their eyes were tragically opened, and they saw their own physical nakedness with a newfound, agonizing awareness. Hastily, they sewed fig leaves together to make rough coverings for themselves. Enraged by the disobedience, God cursed the serpent, condemning it forever to crawl upon its belly. Then he turned to the woman and sternly rebuked her, saying, "I shall greatly multiply your pain and sorrow in childbirth. With terrible agony, you shall bring forth children, and your persistent longing shall be for the authority of your husband, and he shall rule over you completely." To Adam, he declared, "Because you foolishly listened to the voice of your wife and ate from the tree of which I strictly commanded you not to eat, cursed is the very ground for your sake and toil. It will bring forth thorns and thistles in abundance, and you shall eat your bread by the hard sweat of your face until you finally return to the ground from which you were so carefully formed. For dust you fundamentally are, and to dust you shall eventually return. Then the Lord lovingly made garments of animal skins to clothe them, providing protection against the new shame, and he sent them out immediately from the sacred garden. As Adam left the garden, he offered a fragrant sacrifice of frankincense, galbanum, stacte, and costly spices at the rising of the sun, a profound gesture of repentance for his shame and transgression. On that dark day, all the remaining creatures, the beasts, the cattle, the birds, and all that moved upon the earth, lost the precious power of speech. No longer would they speak with one tongue, for they had once universally shared a single common voice. God scattered every creature widely from the Garden of Eden, sending each to its appropriate place upon the earth according to its kind and inherent nature. To Adam alone, of all creation, he gave the means to cover his great shame. This command was explicitly written on the heavenly tablets, that all who understand the sacred law should cover their shame and not expose themselves brazenly as the unholy nations do. In the fourth month, under the new moon, Adam and his wife departed from Eden and made their new home in the rugged land of Elda, the very region where they had first been created. Adam named his wife Eve, the mother of all living. They had no children for a long time, not until the first jubilee had passed, and then Adam came to know her intimately and they bore children. In that new, harsh land, Adam laboriously tilled the soil, applying the knowledge he had been taught while in Eden, striving tirelessly with the earth as it was now sternly commanded to yield. In the third week of the second jubilee, Eve's womb stirred again, and she gave birth to her first son, whom they named Cain. A shadow of destiny seemed to follow, for soon after, in the swift passage of the fourth week, she bore another son, Abel. The family grew again in the fifth week when she brought forth a daughter, and they named her Awan, marking the beginning of the first generation upon the soil outside Eden. But the fragile peace was shattered in the first year of the third jubilee. That day became the darkest in human memory when Cain, consumed by an envy that festered deep within his soul, rose up against his younger brother. They were laboring together in the open field, but the moment Cain struck Abel down, it was a profound act of betrayal. Bitter jealousy drove the blow, for the Lord, in his divine appraisal, had graciously accepted Abel's pure offering, yet had looked with disfavor upon Cain's submission. Instantly, Abel's innocent blood soaked into the newly cultivated ground, and from that depth, a powerful cry ascended. A terrible sound that climbed the vast expanse toward the heavens, bearing undeniable witness to the treachery and demanding swift justice. The Lord himself appeared and confronted the murderer, holding Cain accountable for the lifeblood of his kin. As a direct consequence of this heinous crime, God pronounced a terrible, inescapable sentence. Cain was declared a fugitive, utterly cursed and condemned to roam ceaselessly upon the face of the earth, forever bearing the indelible mark of his violence and alienation. And the solemn verdict was eternally recorded in the celestial volumes. Cursed is the soul who strikes down his neighbor in an act of treachery and guile. Let all who witness this declare, "So be it," let the judgment stand. And let the one who sees this atrocity yet keeps his silence be equally cursed. Because of this absolute necessity for truth, every single sin committed in heaven or upon the earth, whether cloaked in the deepest darkness or exposed in the brightest light, is meticulously reported before the Lord, ensuring that divine justice remains perfectly complete and absolutely true. Adam and his wife descended into a profound, crushing sorrow, mourning the lost life of Abel for a period spanning 4 weeks of years, 28 seasons weighed down by grief. But mercifully, in the fourth year of the fifth week, a beam of joy pierced the darkness of their home. Adam knew his wife once more, and she conceived and bore him another son, whom he named Seth. Adam looked upon the child and proclaimed, "God has raised up for us another seed upon this earth to take the place of Abel, for Cain ruthlessly slew him." In this new life, Adam and Eve found a fragile solace and the hope for a righteous lineage. In the sixth week, Adam and Eve bore another daughter, whom they called Asherah. As the generations began to mingle, Cain took his sister Awan to be his wife, and she bore him a son whom he named Enoch. As the fourth jubilee drew to its close, humanity began to settle and solidify its presence, building the first permanent houses upon the earth. Cain, establishing himself as a patriarch, built the first true city, naming it after his son, Enoch. Adam and Eve continued to fulfill the command to be fruitful, and Eve bore 9 more sons during the course of their long lives. In the 5th week of the 5th Jubilee, Seth followed the established practice and took his sister Asherah as his wife. In the 4th year of the 6th week, she bore him a son, Enos. With Enos came a profound spiritual turning point. It was he who first began to call publicly and reverently upon the sacred name of the Lord upon the earth, thereby setting the essential foundations of dedicated worship and deep spiritual reverence for all the generations that would follow him. In the 7th Jubilee, during the 3rd week, Enos took his sister Noam as his wife, and in the 3rd year of the 5th week, she bore him a son whom he named Kenan. Then, at the very close of the 8th Jubilee, Kenan wed his sister Mueleth, and she bore him a son in the 9th Jubilee, whom he named Mahalalel. During the 2nd week of the 10th Jubilee, Mahalalel took a wife named Dinah, who was the daughter of Barachiel and, therefore, his father's niece. In the 3rd week, during the 6th year, Dinah bore him a son, whom he named Jared. It was in Jared's time, a pivotal era in world history, that the holy angels, known as the Watchers, first descended from the heavens and established themselves upon the earth, having been sent with the singular, divine purpose of teaching humankind the laws of justice and the path of uprightness. In the 11th Jubilee, Jared married a woman named Baraka, who was the daughter of Rezujil and came from the line of his own father's brother. She bore him a son, whom he named Enoch, in the 5th week of the Jubilee, in its 4th year. This Enoch grew to be a man of extraordinary intellect and deep spiritual insight. He was the first among all men born on earth to fully master wisdom, literacy, and the refined art of writing. He carefully recorded the subtle signs displayed in the heavens, maintaining an exact calendar of the months and seasons in order to reveal to men the Lord's precise appointed times and the true, sacred order of the entire year. Enoch was also the first to leave behind a comprehensive and prophetic testimony, meticulously recounting for humankind the great cycles of jubilees and years, setting forth a crystal clear order for the months and the divine Sabbaths. He wrote down not only what had transpired but also what was certain to come, for in his profound sleeps, he was granted visions of the future, revealing the eventual fates of the children of men across every generation until the terrifying final day of judgment. Enoch saw and grasped the entirety of these cosmic truths and faithfully recorded his immense testimony upon the earth as a vital guide for all who would eventually follow the righteous path. In the 12th Jubilee, in the 7th week, Enoch took a wife named Edni, daughter of Danel and niece to his father. In the 6th year of that specific week, she bore him a son, whom he named Methuselah. Enoch himself was eventually granted the unparalleled privilege of dwelling among the angels for a span of 6 full jubilees, during which time they unfolded before him the deepest mysteries of both the heavens and the earth. He dutifully wrote down all he witnessed, the majestic order of the sun, the intricate paths of the stars, and their precise movements, thereby laying down the very foundations of divine wisdom upon the earth. In time, Enoch was compelled by truth to bear witness against the Watchers themselves, who had shamefully corrupted their essence by defiling themselves with the daughters of men. He testified powerfully against their transgression, for they had abandoned their sacred duty to guide men in righteousness and had instead fallen headlong into profound sin, forsaking the eternal holiness that had been so generously entrusted to them. Enoch remained steadfast and unyielding in his testimony, an unwavering pillar of truth and divine justice. As a reward for his faithfulness and his unparalleled knowledge, Enoch was taken suddenly from the company of humankind, lifted miraculously into the glorious, hallowed sanctuary of the Garden of Eden. There, he was granted a position of great majesty and honor, and in that holy place, he commenced the solemn task of writing down the final condemnation and irreversible judgment of the world. Every single act of wickedness perpetrated by the children of men was recorded by his vigilant hand, ensuring that no trespass, however small, would remain unaccounted for in the eternal ledger. Because of this damning record, God eventually brought forth the great flood, allowing the destructive waters to rise up and engulf all the land, even the sacred grounds surrounding Eden. For Enoch was established there as the ultimate, standing witness, a permanent, eternal sign to testify against humanity's generations, meticulously recounting every deed until that final, conclusive day of judgment. It was on the consecrated mountain that Enoch performed his final ritual, burning the sacred incense of the sanctuary, which was rich with sweet, costly spices that rose as an offering profoundly pleasing to the Lord. For the Lord had set apart and consecrated four specific places on earth: the pristine Garden of Eden, the revered Mount of the East, the mountain where you now stand, Mount Sinai, and the glorious Mount Zion. These four places are destined to be fully sanctified in the new creation, so that through them, the entire earth might be perpetually purified from all remaining guilt and lingering uncleanliness for all generations yet to come. In the 14th Jubilee, Methuselah married a woman named Edna, daughter of Azrael and niece of his father. And in the first year of the third week, she bore him a son named Lamech. Then, in the 15th Jubilee, during the third week, Lamech took Betenos, daughter of Barachiel and niece of his father, as his wife. And she bore him a son, whom he named Noah. Lamech looked upon the child with a heart full of hope and proclaimed prophetically, "This son shall bring comfort and rest to me from all my strenuous toil and from the heavy curse that still lingers upon the ground we must labor upon." At the close of the 19th Jubilee, specifically during the seventh week in its sixth year, Adam's long life upon the earth finally reached its terminus. His sons gathered with solemn reverence to bury him in the very soil from which he had been originally formed, thus marking him as the first human being to be laid to rest upon the earth. Adam had lived 70 years short of a full thousand, for 1,000 years is measured as like a single day in the celestial testimony of the heavens. It had been written concerning the forbidden tree of knowledge, "On the very day you eat of it, you shall surely die." And thus, he did not live to complete the full span of that divine day, passing away within its bounds. Later, in that same pivotal year, Cain also met his inevitable violent fate. His house, which he had so painstakingly built, suddenly collapsed upon him, and he was crushed and killed by the very stones that surrounded him. A fate considered a fitting, ironic judgment, as he had used a stone to murder Abel, and now a stone was his tragic undoing. Thus, it was ordained and affirmed in the heavenly records: by the specific weapon a man employs to slay his neighbor, by that same weapon shall he himself be slain. In the precise manner in which he inflicted harm, in that same manner shall the just retribution be dealt to him. In the 25th Jubilee, Noah, the righteous man, took a wife named Amzara, daughter of Rachel and niece of his father. In the first year of the fifth week, she bore him a son named Shem. 4 years later, in the fifth year, she bore Ham, and in the first year of the sixth week, she bore Japheth. And as the population of humankind expanded dramatically across the earth, beautiful and fair daughters were born in increasing numbers. In one specific, fateful year of that jubilee, the mighty angels of God, the watchers who had been sent to guide, saw these human women and took wives from among them, choosing any they desired. Their unholy unions bore sons, and these offspring were fearsome giants, beings of grotesque size and overwhelming strength. Total lawlessness now choked the earth. All flesh became utterly corrupt in its ways and actions. Humanity, cattle, the wild beasts, and the birds, all creation strayed desperately from their ordained, righteous paths, blatantly defying the divine order set by God. They turned upon one another, beginning to devour each other indiscriminately, and the thoughts and hearts of men were fixed on wickedness continually. God looked down upon the ravaged earth and saw the totality of the corruption. Every living thing on the face of the earth had deliberately chosen evil, and he declared with deep sorrow, "I shall wipe away man and every breathing creature of flesh upon the earth that I have created, and I shall not allow it to stand." Yet, amidst the ruin, Noah found extraordinary grace in the eyes of the Lord. God's righteous wrath burned fiercely against the angels who had willfully descended and defiled themselves with humanity. He immediately commanded that they be seized, cast out from their heavenly dominion, and bound securely deep within the earth, separated and confined in unbreakable darkness. A further, terrible command was issued concerning their hybrid children, that those giants would perish violently by the sword and be removed entirely from the land of the living. And God decreed, "My spirit, the breath of life, shall not remain within man forever, for in their corruption, they are nothing more than flesh. Therefore, their days shall be strictly limited to 120 years." He then sent a sword of judgment directly into the midst of the giants, and they were driven by madness to turn upon one another, each brutally slaying his neighbor until they were utterly destroyed from the earth. Their sinning fathers, the bound watchers, watched helplessly from their deep confines as their giant sons perished. Afterward, those rebellious angels who had sinned were bound in the utmost depths of the earth, to remain confined there until the day of great and final judgment, when all who have utterly corrupted their ways shall stand eternally condemned. In the wake of this vast destruction, God began the process of remaking the earth, instilling within his remaining creatures a new, inherent, and righteous nature. No longer would they be able to sin so fundamentally in their very essence. Each would be aligned perfectly with his eternal will and divine purpose. The comprehensive judgment of every creature and all creation was irrevocably engraved upon the heavenly records. There is no hidden corner of heaven, no depth of the earth, no realm of light or darkness, not even Sheol or the deepest abyss, that is beyond the scope of his judgment. All things have their predetermined fate written down, patiently awaiting the day when they shall each answer strictly according to their deeds. God judges the great by the greatness of their transgression, the small by the smallness of their offense, and each according to the exact way they have walked. He demonstrates absolutely no partiality, nor does he accept any gifts or bribes to sway his perfect judgment. Even if one were to offer the accumulated treasures of the entire earth, he would not be moved from his righteous decree. His justice is pure, unwavering, and eternally complete. As for the future children of Israel, it is written and decreed that if they eventually turn back to him in sincere righteousness, he will forgive their transgressions and show mercy once each year to all who truly renounce their guilt. But for those generations who corrupted their ways before the great flood, only Noah was found worthy. His singular righteousness alone was sufficient to save his family from the flood's total destruction. For his heart remained pure and unwavering, obeying precisely all that was commanded of him, never once straying from the narrow path appointed to him. And so, with heavy finality, the Lord declared that he would destroy every living creature on earth, the wicked humans, the cattle, the beasts, the birds, and all that moves upon the ground. Then, with a voice that commanded absolute obedience, the Lord addressed Noah, saying, "Build for yourself a massive ark, a sanctuary of refuge that will float above the waters of the great flood that shall soon cover the whole land." Noah obeyed the divine command instantly, constructing the vast ark precisely as he had been instructed. This monumental task he completed in the 27th Jubilee, in the 5th week and the 5th year, under the light of the new moon on the first month. Then, as the 6th year dawned, on the new moon of the 2nd month, he and all the creatures that God had gathered and brought to him entered the sanctuary of the ark. And on the 17th evening of that same month, the Lord himself sealed the ark, closing the enormous door from the outside, just as an ominous darkness descended upon the world. Then, in a terrifying display of cosmic power, the Lord opened 7 mighty floodgates in the heavens and unleashed 7 great fountains from the very depths of the earth. Torrents of violent rain poured relentlessly from the skies for 40 full days and 40 nights, and the waters of the deep surged upward until the entire world was submerged in a terrifying ocean. The destructive waters rose higher and higher, covering even the tallest mountain peaks by a full 15 cubits, and the ark was lifted easily and carried upon the vast, heaving, endless flood. For 5 relentless months, 150 days in total, the destructive waters reigned supreme over the earth, and the ark drifted aimlessly across the face of the endless, boundless sea. But as time passed, guided by divine will, the ark finally came gently to rest upon Mount Luber, one of the towering summits of the Ararat range. In the 4th month, on the precise day of the new moon, the fountains of the great deep were sealed and closed, and the heavens abruptly withheld their torrential rain. By the 7th month, on the new moon, the abysses of the earth began slowly to open, and the overwhelming floodwaters began their necessary descent, returning to the unseen depths below. In the 10th month, the highest mountain peaks visibly emerged, and when the new moon of the first month shone again, the dried earth lay visible once more, glistening in the fresh dawn of rebirth. As the waters receded fully, the earth was deemed completely dry by the second month of the 7th year, on the 17th day. Noah, at long last, opened the door of the ark and released the saved beasts, the birds, and every creature that had been preserved within. On the new moon of the 3rd month, he too left the ark, his heart soaring with reverence and profound gratitude. There, upon that very sacred mountain, he immediately built an altar, consecrating it to the Lord with offerings intended to cleanse the earth of its great, accumulated guilt. He chose a young goat, sacrificing its blood as an atonement for the devastation and widespread corruption wrought upon the land. Then, gathering a clean ox, a strong ram, 7 perfect lambs, each only a year old, and a kid from his goats, he prepared a sacred, comprehensive offering upon the newly built altar. He sprinkled salt and poured sanctified oil upon the sacrifice, mingling the offerings with wine and fragrant frankincense, filling the air with a sweet, deeply pleasing scent. The Lord breathed in the delightful aroma of the sacrifice, and his heart was deeply stirred with mercy. In that mercy, he made a solemn, binding covenant with Noah and all his descendants, declaring, "Never again shall there be a flood of such magnitude to destroy the earth and all its creatures. While the earth remains in its place, seed time and harvest shall never cease their cycle. Cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, they shall endure their rhythm perpetually." The Lord then spoke further to Noah and his descendants, "Be fruitful and multiply greatly, filling the earth with abundant life and blessings. I shall place the instinctive fear and awesome dread of you in every creature upon the land and in the sea. All beasts, birds, and creatures that move upon the earth, and all fish in the waters, I now give to you for food, just as freely as I gave the green plants. But heed my most crucial command, do not consume the flesh with its lifeblood still contained within it, for the life force of each creature is inextricably bound within its blood." The Lord issued a further grave warning, saying, "If a man violently sheds the blood of another, by the hand of man shall his own blood be shed. For humanity is made in the very sacred image of God." Noah and his sons, profoundly humbled, swore a binding oath before God to obey this solemn law concerning blood. And from that day onward, they upheld a sacred covenant with the Lord, sworn on the summit of the sacred mountain, vowing that no blood would ever pass their lips. For this was a strict command intended to last through all the subsequent generations of the earth. To Noah and his sons, the Lord gave a magnificent sign of this everlasting promise. He placed a vibrant rainbow in the clouds as a glorious symbol of his covenant, a vivid, permanent reminder that never again would a devastating flood engulf and destroy all life on earth. And it was immediately decreed and inscribed on the heavenly tablets that, in remembrance of the salvation and covenant, they would celebrate the Feast of Weeks every single year, annually renewing their eternal commitment to the covenant. This Feast of Weeks, a cherished and ancient celebration dating back to creation itself, continued faithfully until the days of Noah, spanning 26 full jubilees and 5 weeks of years. For 7 more jubilees thereafter, Noah and his sons meticulously honored this sacred festival. But tragically, after Noah's death, his sons gradually drifted away from the sacred practice until the patriarch Abraham faithfully reclaimed it. In much later days, the children of Israel, too, would forget this holy observance until it was powerfully revived anew on the mountain of Sinai. Now, the Lord commanded that Israel should strictly observe this festival in every generation, a vibrant remembrance to be celebrated one specific day each year in the designated month, a dual feast of weeks and first fruits. The Lord instructed that this holy observance was to endure through all time, a commandment eternally binding upon the people of Israel. The Lord also decreed that Noah should carefully mark the new moons of the 1st, 4th, 7th, and 10th months as holy days of deep remembrance. These were the appointed times specifically chosen to recall the precise divisions of the year, the moments of decisive divine intervention, and Noah faithfully established them as perpetual feasts in honor of all that had passed. Each season held its appointed place on the heavenly tablets, and so Noah kept them as an enduring memorial for all future generations. The Lord set forth that a full year should be measured by the precise count of 364 days, ensuring that every feast, sacred Sabbath, and season would remain in perfect, perpetual order. Should they fail to meticulously observe this precise reckoning, the sacred cycles would inevitably falter, and the holy observances would be thrown into irreparable disarray, and in forgetting the true, divine order, Israel would surely lose sight of the appointed times and their spiritual significance. The Lord's message was delivered with stern gravity. If they abandon the perfect order inscribed upon the heavenly tablets, their mandated celebrations will inevitably fall into corruption. They will foolishly mistake the unholy for the holy, confounding the sacred days with the profane and common. They will forsake the correct count of the years and indulge in practices foreign and offensive to my commands. For this crucial reason, the Lord charged Noah, and through him all his subsequent descendants, with the sacred duty of upholding the ordained cycle of the heavens, that the years would not drift away from their rightful places, nor the solemn feasts fall out of their proper sequence. And thus, the Lord's covenant of life and blessing remained eternally inscribed upon the face of the earth and in the heavens, a sacred and permanent testimony to the unfailing promise given to Noah and his descendants for all time. In the seventh week of this jubilee, during its first year, Noah diligently took to the land where his ark had finally come to rest, upon the restorative slopes of Mount Luber, one of the massive Ararat mountains. With reverent, hopeful hands, he planted vines in this new soil, patiently waiting for them to yield their fruit. Seasons passed in accordance with the renewed covenant, and in the fourth year, his vines finally bore grapes, their clusters ripening richly in the seventh month, a welcome reward he had awaited with patience and faith. With this precious harvest, Noah expertly crafted wine, storing it carefully in vessels, watching over it until the fifth year, holding off until the new moon of the first month for the proper celebration. At last, he celebrated the fruit of his labor, his heart lifted with profound joy. On that sacred day, he prepared a great feast and made special offerings to the Lord, an offering of deep reverence and gratitude. A young ox, a ram, seven perfect lambs, each only a year old, and a kid from his goats he offered, seeking atonement for himself and for his three sons. He first prepared the young goat, placing its purifying blood upon the altar. With precision and ceremonial care, he arranged the rich fat upon the fire, then laid out the flesh of the ox, ram, and lambs. All their offerings he mingled with oil, kindling a sacrificial fire that rose in purifying smoke, and he sprinkled the altar with wine, as fragrant incense filled the air, sending up a sweet and immensely pleasing aroma to the Lord, his God. Noah rejoiced deeply that day, drinking freely of his own crafted wine, he and his sons sharing in this unexpected joy together. But as evening settled, Noah retreated to the privacy of his tent. The wine had made him drowsy and perhaps incautious, and he lay down, drifting into sleep, his clothing unfastened and undone. And there he lay, unaware and exposed within his tent. Then Ham, Noah's second son, came upon him and saw his father lying there uncovered in his vulnerability. Instead of showing respect and turning away, he left the tent and spoke openly of the sight to his two brothers outside, mocking his father's shame. But Shem and Japheth, hearing this disrespectful tale, took a decisively different course. They held a garment upon their shoulders and walked backward into their father's tent with the utmost care, deliberately averting their gaze so they would not violate their father's privacy by seeing his shame. They reverently laid the garment over their father, hiding his nakedness completely from their sight. When Noah finally awoke from his wine-induced sleep, he instantly knew the profound dishonor his younger son had perpetrated. Wrath and deep sorrow filled his ancient heart, and he cursed Ham's son, saying, "Cursed be Canaan, an enslaved servant shall he forever be to his brothers." Then, turning to the righteous sons, Noah blessed Shem, declaring, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be subjugated and serve him." To Japheth, he spoke a blessing of expansion. "May God greatly enlarge Japheth, and may he be granted the honor to dwell securely within the tents of Shem, and may Canaan also be bound to serve them both." Ham, stung by his father's powerful curse upon his son, grew bitter, and in a fit of resentful pride, he departed from the protective shadow of Noah's dwelling, taking his four sons, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. Ham struck out on his own path. In that distant place, he established a settlement and built himself a sprawling city, which he proudly named Neolatamukay, honoring his wife. Japheth, upon witnessing his brother's accomplishment and stung by a deep sense of competitive envy, likewise set about founding his own settlement, which he designated Adatanesis, a tribute to his own wife. But Shem, ever mindful of his father's counsel and desiring tranquility, chose to remain near Noah, establishing his city, Sedekitelbab, by the mountain's enduring side, dedicated to the legacy of his beloved wife. Thus, the three great cities came to stand in proximity to the towering Mount Lubar. Sedekitelbab rose upon the sacred eastern slopes, Neolatamukay was established in the fertile south, and Adatanesis secured its position to the west, and from these patriarchs flowed the new generations that would populate the earth. From Shem came Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, who was born a mere 2 years after the waters of the flood receded Lud and Aram. And from Japheth descended Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. In the 28th jubilee of the world's age, the venerable Noah summoned all his descendants to him. With grave ceremony, he solemnly imparted the profound wisdom and divine laws he had been granted, urging them above all else to pursue unwavering righteousness, to cloak their own failings and shame with dignity and quiet humility, to honor the majesty of their Creator, to respect the authority of father and mother, to hold their neighbors in true affection, and to diligently keep their souls pure and free from the defilement of fornication, uncleanness, and all forms of sin. Noah's voice grew heavy, thick with the memory of immense sorrow and the ancient calamities that had called forth the great flood. For three monumental offenses did the devastating waters come upon the whole earth. He began, his gaze piercing the assembled generations. First, for the unholy and profane unions that arose when the watchers, those mighty sons of heaven, defied the celestial boundary set for them and sought out the daughters of men, taking them as wives entirely as they pleased, sparking the very beginnings of all uncleanliness. From these forbidden couplings, they bore strange, monstrous children, those brutal giants known as the Nephilim, whose savage and lawless ways brought chaos and widespread corruption. The giants, driven by their vile appetites, turned savagely upon one another, killing and consuming, the powerful preying mercilessly on the weak until the blood of kinsmen stained the very foundations of the land. Secondly, in the due course of time, their escalating violence turned against even the innocent beasts, the swift birds of the air, and all creatures that moved across the face of the earth. Thirdly, the very innermost imagination of men became utterly dark and distorted, thinking only of evil, always actively seeking to do grievous harm to their fellows and to transgress the established order. And so, the Lord, the great judge, looked down upon this broken earth, and in his boundless sorrow and his unyielding justice, he swept it all away, sparing none save for me, my sons, and the company of creatures that entered the ark with us. And yet I look upon you now, my sons, and I perceive with dread that you have already begun to turn your steps from the path of true righteousness. You engage in petty quarrels, you harbor corrosive envy in your hearts, and you deliberately set yourselves apart from one another. Noah's aged voice trembled with terrible foreboding. I hold great fear for your fate, my children. Even now, the dark legions of the demons seek ceaselessly to seduce you and your innocent offspring. After the Lord gathers me unto my fathers, will you too begin to spill each other's precious blood? Will you bring such utter ruin upon yourselves, warring until none remains standing upon the earth? Hear this command. Any who dare to shed the blood of another, or who presume to consume blood as food, will be utterly destroyed, stripped of their descendants, leaving no legacy beneath heaven. They shall descend instantly to Sheol, to the desolate place of condemnation, cast headlong into the darkness of the abyss, meeting a swift and violent end. Therefore, let no single drop of blood remain upon you unatoned. Noah continued, his voice regaining its stern authority. Wherever you have slain beasts or fowls, cover that blood immediately and with solemn care, burying it in the earth. Guard yourselves diligently, and let no soul among you consume blood. cover it, for this sacred command I pass to you and your future descendants, to all flesh that draws breath upon the earth. Do not permit the life essence that resides within the blood to be defiled or handled wantonly by the hands of man. Know this absolute truth. The earth shall not be fully cleansed of the blood that is shed wrongfully upon its soil except by the very blood of those who shed it. My children, attend closely, for what I tell you now must be etched permanently into the depth of your hearts. Pursue righteousness with every fiber of your strength. Let rigorous justice be your constant guide in all dealings. May you be immovably planted in a righteous legacy that spreads its roots across the entire earth, so that your glory may rise like incense, a profound and visible testament before the face of our God, the Sovereign One who mercifully spared me from the flood's deadly torrents, the Almighty who granted us this miraculous new life. Behold, you will soon journey forth, building powerful cities, planting wide fields with all the nourishing plants that cover the earth, and filling your orchards with fruit-bearing trees. Yet, remember this instruction. For the first 3 years, no fruit is permitted to be gathered or eaten. Only in the fourth year shall you deem its yield sacred, offering its best and choicest first fruits to the Most High, who created the vast heavens and the firm earth. Bring the finest of your wine and your purest oil as dedicated offerings, setting them respectfully on the Lord's altar in unending gratitude. What remains after the offering is for the ordained servants of the Lord's house to consume, as they gather in assembly before his holy altar. He paused, the intensity of his prophetic gaze pressing into their souls. And in the fifth year of planting, let the great release be made in perfect righteousness, so that all debts, burdens, and obligations may be lifted in utter fairness. By following this path of order and justice, you shall truly flourish, and all that your hands plant will surely prosper. These commandments I deliver to you come directly from the ancient wisdom passed down through our righteous forefathers. Enoch, the father of Methuselah, Methuselah, the father of Lamech, and from Lamech directly to me. Each successive generation was carefully instructed in these timeless ways. Now, my sons, I too pass this vital legacy and sacred heritage on to you, exactly as Enoch commanded us in the earliest days of the world. Let this essential guidance be the anchor that sustains you through all your days. In the 29th Jubilee, during the first week of that period, Arpachshad, the steadfast son of Shem, took a wife named Rezuajah, who was the daughter of Susan, and herself a daughter of Elam. In the third year of their harmonious union, she bore him a son, whom they named Kinam. As Kinam matured, his father diligently taught him the fundamental art of writing. Kinam became intensely curious, driven by a restless urge to find a suitable place to establish his own independent city. During his extensive search, he stumbled upon ancient carvings etched into a massive rock, inscriptions left behind by the generations that perished in the deluge. Reading the cryptic words etched there, he realized with a mixture of excitement and terror that they held the profound, forbidden teachings of the Watchers, a hidden lore that detailed the complex movements of the sun, the phases of the moon, and the constellations of the stars, revealing the secret signs of the heavens. Captivated by this dangerous knowledge, he copied every detail of it, but a consuming fear gripped him. He dared not utter a single word to Noah, lest he incur his fierce wrath. As time marched on, Kinam married Melcah, daughter of Madai, a descendant of the line of Japheth, in the 30th Jubilee. By the fourth year of that union, they were blessed with a son, whom Kinam named Shelah, proclaiming, "Indeed, I have been sent forth by God to see a new age." Shelah, in the fullness of time, took a wife named Muakeh, daughter of Kest, who was his own father's brother. In the 31st Jubilee, they brought forth a son named Eber. Eber, when he reached the age of maturity, married Azurad, a daughter of the mighty hunter Nebrod. In the 32nd Jubilee, she gave birth to Peleg. In those darkening days, Noah's numerous descendants began in secret to divide the earth among themselves, naming the child Peleg, signifying division, for the earth was already being parceled out. They kept their ambitious plans meticulously hidden from Noah until the task was accomplished. Then, as the 33rd Jubilee dawned upon the land, they approached their father and, guided by the patriarch Noah, they formally divided the entire earth into three immense portions. Shem, Ham, and Japheth each received their designated lot, the inheritance decreed for their respective lineages. They reached out and solemnly accepted the written record of this great division from Noah's trembling hand. Shem's lot, inscribed by the hand of divine destiny, encompassed the central and most fertile lands of the earth. From the towering mountain range of Rapha to the great and rushing river Tina, it stretched purposefully toward the west, embracing the deep waters and the vast expanse of the great sea. All the lands that lay directly northward of this region fell to Japheth, while the choice southern lands became part of Shem's domain. The boundaries extended along the vast coastal sea to the territory of Carasso, reaching southward, encompassing the crucial edge of the Egyptian Sea. Noah looked upon this majestic portion that had been allocated to Shem and felt his heart swell with profound joy and thanksgiving. For it was then that he vividly remembered his own ancient prophecy, the words he had once spoken with unshakable conviction. Blessed be the Lord, the eternal God of Shem. May the Lord choose to dwell among Shem's people, resting securely in their midst as their eternal and unwavering guide. He came, then, to understand the sacred and inherent nature of certain holy places in the world, realizing fully that the Garden of Eden was indeed the holiest of holies, the very personal dwelling place of the Lord God. Mount Sinai stood as the fiery, immutable heart of the barren desert, and Mount Zion was revealed to be the very sacred center of the earth itself. These three paramount sacred sites were meticulously crafted by divine design, each one facing the others, creating a powerful, enduring trinity of holy places across the breadth of the world. In a state of reverent awe, he lifted his powerful voice in blessing, praising the God of gods, who had mercifully placed his divine word within him, enabling him to speak eternal wisdom and blessing for the ages. He understood that a sacred, everlasting blessing had been bestowed upon Shem and his lineage, a blessing that would stretch across all future generations, forever linking them to a vast, temperate, and bountiful land. Their inheritance encompassed all the lands adjacent to Eden and the Red Sea, reaching eastward to the distant shores of India, including the whole coastline of the Red Sea, the mountains of Bashan, and all the forested regions of Lebanon and the scattered islands of Kaftar. It was a land filled with towering mountain peaks like Sanur and Amana, stretching northward to Ashur's forbidding mountains, and reaching as far as Elam, Ashur, Babel, Susan, and Maidai. This favored land extended all the way to the mountains of Ararat and beyond, into the northern regions past the northern seas. A land truly blessed, spacious, and overflowing with divine goodness. To Ham, a second portion was carefully allotted, extending beyond the great river Gin to the right side of the Garden of Eden, spreading consistently southward. This hot and arid inheritance reached into the fiery, desolate mountain ranges, spreading westward to the vast Sea of Adal and continuing to the treacherous Sea of Mayuke, where the waters swallowed all things that could not be instantly destroyed. The land then curved northward toward the distant edges of Gader, carefully tracing the restless coasts of the Great Sea, moving along the waters until it circled back near the river Gin and came to rest on the right side of the Garden of Eden. This expansive land was permanently marked as Ham's eternal inheritance, his rightful portion for him and his descendants for all subsequent generations. The third and final portion was destined for Japheth, extending from the river Tina, moving steadily northward along the river's flowing course. His vast territory stretched relentlessly northeast across the entire bleak region of Gog and encompassed all lands lying to the far east. Japheth's inheritance extended much further north, reaching the mountains of Kelt, and stretching toward the cold sea of Mayuke and eastward to the outer borders of Gader, before curving westward to Farah, then turning toward Aphrag, and spreading eastward to the powerful waters of the Sea of Miet. It continued northeast until it met the boundary of the river Tina, eventually reaching the boundary of the mountain Rapha, marking the absolute northernmost edges of his expansive inheritance. This great, cold land, along with five prominent and isolated islands in the north, was designated for Japheth and his descendants as their enduring portion forever. Though distinctly colder than the other assigned lands, it was a place of immense strength and vast, unconquered expanse. Thus, the lands of Ham, Shem, and Japheth were established as distinct. Ham's portion was intensely hot, Shem's was temperate and fruitful, and Japheth's was cold and mighty. Ham then proceeded to divide his allotted inheritance among his own sons. For Cush, the first and choice portion lay to the east, with Mizraim's portion immediately to his west, Put's land extending beyond Mizraim, and Canaan's inheritance settling along the distant western coasts by the Great Sea. Similarly, Shem divided his immense inheritance among his own sons. Elam received the eastern lands by the great river Tigris, extending across the entire breadth of India, the shores of the Red Sea, the waters of Dedan, and the mountains of Mebri and Elah. His inheritance included the plains of Susan and stretched toward Pharnak, down to the Red Sea and the river Tina. For Ashur, the second portion comprised the whole rich land of Ashur, including Nineveh, the plains of Shinar, and stretching to the borders of India, curving around the sacred rivers. Arpachshad's portion, the third, spanned the crucial region of the Chaldees east of the Euphrates, reaching the shores of the Red Sea and encompassing the desert waters to the tongue of the sea that faced Egypt. His lands included Lebanon, Sanur, and Amana, extending up to the mighty Euphrates. Aram received the fourth portion, the heartland of Mesopotamia, nestled perfectly between the Tigris and Euphrates, extending northward to the boundaries of the Chaldees and to the mountains of Ashur and the land of Arara. Lud received the fifth portion, which covered the mountains of Ashur, extending to the Great Sea and the eastern borders of his brother Ashur's lands. Japheth then divided his inheritance among his seven sons. Gomer received the eastern lands on the north side of the great river Tina. Magog's portion lay in the remote northern regions, stretching inward to the Sea of Miat. Madai was given the lands west of his brothers, stretching toward the numerous islands and their coasts. Javan received every island situated along the boundaries of Lud's portion. Tubal inherited the rugged region by the geographical tongues of land that extended along Lud's boundary, and Meshech claimed all territories past the third tongue, reaching eastward of Gader. Tiras was allotted the seventh portion, which included four prominent islands in the sea, reaching toward the lands of Ham, while the isolated islands of Kamaturi became the reserved inheritance for Arpachshad's descendants. In the solemn presence of their aged father, Noah, the sons of Noah gravely divided the lands among their own sons, assigning each lineage his fixed and rightful portion. Noah, firm and resolute in his command, made them all swear an unbreakable, terrifying oath. He invoked a severe curse upon anyone who might ever attempt to seize land not rightfully his by lot and boundary. This was done to ensure that each line respected the exact boundaries set for them, for this was a divine, eternal inheritance meant to endure forever. The sons of Noah, in one powerful voice, pledged their absolute allegiance to the oath, declaring, "So be it, so be it." They swore this vow not only for themselves but for all their countless descendants, for every future generation until the profound day of judgment, the day when the Lord God would return to execute his judgment with the sword and consuming fire, to purge the earth of all the unclean wickedness of those who dared to defy him. On that momentous day, he would deal with every transgression, every act of impurity, every sin that had filled the earth with corruption, lust, and lawlessness. In the third week of that sacred jubilee, dark forces began to stir across the newly settled lands. Unclean, malicious demons rose up from the abyss and began immediately to tempt and lead astray the unsuspecting descendants of Noah's sons, seeking to destroy them and cloud their hearts with malice. Distressed deeply by these wicked, tormenting spirits afflicting their children, Noah's sons came to him, pleading with the venerable patriarch to intercede. They reported how these vile demons were deceiving, blinding, and even cruelly claiming the very lives of their children's children. Moved to the depths of his soul by their urgent plea, Noah knelt upon the ground and prayed fervently to the Lord, pouring out his heart before the God of all living spirits. O God, Lord of all spirits, you who have shown me boundless, undeserved mercy, you who saved me and my sons from the wrathful waters of the flood, sparing me when you justly condemned the sons of wickedness. Indeed, your grace has been immeasurable, your mercy has preserved my soul. Now I beg you, let your grace extend over my sons as well. Do not permit these wicked spirits to rule unchecked over them, lest they be utterly destroyed from the face of this earth. Bless me and my sons, that we may multiply and fill this earth as you have ordained. And you know well, my Lord, what the watchers, the terrible fathers of these vile spirits, did in my time. I ask that you bind these spirits tightly, imprison them forever, hold them fast in the desolate place of condemnation, and let them not bring ruin upon the children of your servant. These spirits are filled only with malice, created solely to destroy. Let them have no dominion over the spirits of the living, for only you, O God, possess infinite power over all spirits. Grant that they may have no power whatsoever over the sons of the righteous, now and forevermore. In powerful answer, the Lord commanded his numerous messengers to bind all of the evil spirits and cast them down. But then, the chief of these spirits, the cunning Mestima, came forward and spoke, pleading passionately with the Creator. Lord Creator, allow some small remnant of these spirits to remain before me, so they may obey my voice and carry out my will among the sons of men. Without a remnant of them, I cannot execute my purposes upon the earth, for I use them to corrupt, mislead, and test humanity before the final judgment. Great indeed is the inherent wickedness of humankind. The Lord God considered this request and decreed, let 1/10 of these spirits remain with him, and let the other 9 parts descend instantly into the place of condemnation. Then the Lord wisely instructed one of his attending angels to reveal to Noah all the medicinal knowledge of the earth, for he foresaw that humankind, in its weakness, would inevitably stray from the path of righteousness and become susceptible to demonic influence. Following his divine word, the angels bound the malicious spirits securely in the place of judgment, leaving only 1/10 of their numbers under Mestima's dark authority on the earth. The angelic messenger then patiently taught Noah about every medicine and herb that could heal the many ailments caused by these spirits, as well as the remedies to counter their powerful seductions and subtle deceit. Noah meticulously wrote down everything he learned in a great book, carefully recording every detail of each medicine and its use as instructed. In this way, the children of Noah were prophetically shielded from the potential harm of the evil spirits. Noah passed down this precious, protective knowledge to his eldest son, Shem, whom he loved above all his other sons, entrusting him with the secret wisdom required to protect future generations. After completing his mission on earth, the patriarch Noah was honorably gathered to his fathers and was buried on the revered Mount Luber in the highlands of Ararat. He had lived for 950 magnificent years, 19 full jubilees, 2 weeks, and 5 additional years in all. Throughout the entirety of his long days, Noah stood out among humankind for his perfect righteousness, a true and dedicated servant of the Lord. Yet only Enoch surpassed him in closeness to the divine, for Enoch had been singled out and set apart for an even greater eternal purpose. His unique role was to bear unwavering witness across all generations, recounting the deeds of fallen humanity and preserving the infallible testimony of righteousness until the final, great day of judgment. In the 33rd Jubilee, during the first year of the second week, Peleg, son of Eber, took a wife for himself. Her name was Lamna, daughter of Sinaar, and in the 4th year of that week, she bore him a son. He named the child Reu, saying prophetically to himself, see now, the children of men have already fallen into wickedness, driven by their dark and excessive ambition to build for themselves a singular city and an impossibly tall tower in the distant land of Shinar. So it was that humanity collectively left the pure land of Ararat and journeyed eastward to the plains of Shinar. And in those tumultuous days, they began construction on a colossal city and a towering structure of immense size, saying proudly to one another, come, let us labor together and build a stable path to the heavens, that we might ascend to the very realm of God and challenge his authority. With unified determination and staggering manpower, they set to work, and by the 4th week, they had mastered the dangerous art of making bricks by fire. These hardened bricks they used as permanent stone, binding them together with thick asphalt, a sticky substance that poured forth abundantly from the sea and from the natural fountains of Shinar. They built tirelessly, pouring 43 years of effort into the endeavor. Their tower grew taller and ever taller. Its width spanned 203 bricks, each individual brick 1/3 of a cubit in height, and the finished tower rose to a staggering height of 8,150 feet. Its massive walls stretched 7,800 feet on one side and 18,000 feet on the other, a permanent, defiant monument to human ambition and spiritual insolence. Then the Lord God, seeing this monstrous spectacle of human pride, spoke to the assembled heavenly hosts. Look upon them, they are united as one perverse people, all sharing a common language, and this is only the very beginning of what their defiance will attempt. Now, nothing they imagine to do will restrain them. Come, let us descend immediately and confound their language, so they will no longer understand one another's speech. Thus, they shall be scattered and divided into countless cities and nations, and their shared, rebellious purpose will dissolve entirely, until the great day of final judgment. The Lord himself descended in glory, and his mighty hosts descended alongside him, to personally witness the construction of the city and the tower built by the children of men. Then, in a moment, he scattered their coherent language, leaving them utterly unable to understand one another. Confusion and senseless noise overtook them instantly, and they abandoned their great, arrogant work, leaving the tower eternally unfinished. And from that decisive day forward, the land of Shinar became known forever as Babel, for there the Lord had confused the universal language of all humankind and scattered them violently into their own cities and fledgling nations, each group speaking its own newly formed tongue. To complete this profound judgment, the Lord sent a mighty, terrifying wind against the tower, toppling the colossal structure violently to the ground. It lay as a shattered ruin between Ashur and Babylon in the land of Shinar, and they named that place Overthrow, for it was there that human pride was finally humbled. In the first year of the 34th Jubilee, during the fourth week, the confused peoples dispersed forever from Shinar. As Ham and his loyal sons journeyed, they moved generally southward, settling in the vast lands that had been justly allotted to him. But Canaan, casting his greedy eyes upon the incredibly fertile land of Lebanon stretching toward the river of Egypt, found it exceedingly pleasing and chose deliberately not to go westward to his designated inheritance by the sea. Instead, in open defiance, he settled in the plains of Lebanon, stretching his borders eastward and westward from the banks of the Jordan River to the edge of the sea. When Ham, along with his other sons Cush and Mizraim, learned of this great transgression, they angrily warned him, saying, "Canaan, you have wickedly chosen to settle in a land that is not yours by lot, a land that did not come to us by the divine draw. You must not do this great wrong, for if you persist in this defiance, you and your descendants will bring utter ruin upon yourselves, condemned by the very same spirit of rebellion that brought you here. By rebellion, you have claimed this sacred land, and by rebellion, your children shall fall and be utterly rooted out forever. Do not presume to dwell in the inheritance of Shem, for it was given by lot to Shem and his descendants alone among the children of men. But Canaan, filled with his own self-will and lust for possession, paid no heed whatsoever to their terrible warning. He remained stubbornly in the land of Lebanon, occupying the forbidden ground, the territory he unlawfully claimed, a defiant stretch of fertile ground that swept from the northern reaches of Hamath all the way down to the sun-drenched borders of Egypt. There, in brazen disobedience to the assigned lots, he and his progeny established a permanent residence, where they abide even to this very day. This rebellious act, this profound rejection of the divine allotment, permanently stained the geography, causing the region to be forever known by the name of its usurper, Canaan. Meanwhile, the line of Japheth, adhering more closely to the mandated paths, undertook their lengthy journey toward the western waters. They sought the distant shorelines, eventually settling the expansive, often rugged territory that had been designated for their lineage. Yet, among them, Madai, one of Japheth's strong sons, found himself profoundly unsettled. The harsh salinity of the coast and the endless maritime horizon did not satisfy his ambition for a secure, productive heartland. He looked eastward, envying the rich internal plains held by his maternal relatives. Seeking a more suitable place for his growing clan, Madai approached his influential kin from the line of Shem, the powerful Elam, the shrewd Ashur, and Arpachshad, his own wife's cherished brother. With humility, a rare trait among the younger patriarchs, he laid out his dilemma, asking not for domination, but for a modest portion of their allocated fertile ground. Recognizing the sincerity of his request and the closeness of the family bond, the sons of Shem showed surprising magnanimity and granted his plea. Madai thus moved his entire clan inland, settling in the rolling, resource-rich high plains, establishing a deep connection to his wife's family in the region of the Eastern Mountains. It was here that Madai asserted his dominion, assuming the mantle of the founding patriarch over this new settlement. He declared that the land would henceforth be known as Media. This strategic naming ensured that his personal legacy, his courage to seek a better home, would not be lost to the shifting sands of time, securing his memory among his descendants for all the ages that have followed.